I took the first flight out of New York and landed in L.A. at around 10 a.m. local time. We'd arranged to meet at a diner in the City of Commerce just outside downtown Los Angeles. I took a cab from the airport and got to this damn ugly diner a little after 11. I sat down in a booth and read the paper for half an hour. About a quarter to 12, two guys walk in. I didn't know what Bernie Marcus looked like. They immediately come over to me. I'm dressed in a business suit. I start to get up, and I can't get up. What the hell is wrong? Somebody has left a wad of chewing gum on the damn vinyl banquette, and my ass was stuck to the seat. Was I embarrassed? Sure I was, but I also thought, this is good luck. The two guys were Bernie Marcus and his lawyer, Irwin Diller. Bernie was tall with gray hair and glasses, nice face. I liked him right away, and Diller looked like a lawyer, serious as a tax audit. I later found out that Marcus had brought his attorney because he, Bernie, was having some stress with the head of Dalen, Sanford Sigaloff, remember that name, and he wanted to make sure he didn't do anything improper when he met with me, such as giving insider information. He also had his lawyer there to size me up. The chewing gum on my ass was a great start. I laughed it off, they sat down, and we began to talk. I did most of the talking at first. I had a lot of questions about Handy Dan. Are there any non-recurring gains, I asked. Are there any one-time charges? Are there any one-time gains? Bernie was open with me. He knew that I was trying to help Gary, and he had a good feeling for Gary. He also knew that I was thinking about buying stock and wanted to learn about his company. All his answers were the right answers. It was clear this thing was spotless. And I was starting to get excited. Hell, I was bouncing in my seat. This company was a major steal. And unbelievably, Bernie Marcus owned no stock in it at all. He had no options. He was strictly a professional hired gun. He was running that company and running it very well for just his salary. Mr. Marcus, I said, I don't know what you do with your money, but I'm going to buy every share of stock I can in your company. And pardon my French, when I get done with this fucking thing, it ain't going to be selling at $3 a share. I would strongly advise you to get back to your office, mortgage your house, and buy Handy Dan stock. Lots of it. Please, it's not going to be here for long. Three of us shook hands, and there were smiles all around. Well, the lawyer almost smiled. I later found out that after I left, Diller turned to Bernie and said, Bernie, just my gut. You can trust this guy. And I got in the cab, sticky seat of my pants and all, and headed back to the airport. When I got back to New York, I began buying every damn share of Handy Dan I could lay my hands on. The total capitalization was about 2.2 million shares, of which about 475,000 shares were in the hands of the public. Dalen owned 81% of the company, and the public owned 19%, which would turn out to be a very significant number. Over the next few months, as I bought these shares, naturally the price rose from $3 to $9 to $12. The stock was doing very well. As a matter of fact, some Fridays, if I wanted to have a good weekend and the stock was selling for $11, I'd go to the trading desk in my office and say, bid 12 for 200 shares of stock, and the damn stock would go to $12, and I wouldn't have to buy a single share. Understand, I'm a little meshuggah. But if the rest of the world is sane, I don't mind being meshuggah. I was able to buy just about all of the publicly traded shares, with the exception of one block of 50,000, which it turned out was owned by the Catholic Congregation of the Most Holy Redeemer in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, or as they're also known, the Redemptorist Fathers. I knew the guy who sold it to them, a broker named Jimmy Keene, made a nice commission. I phoned the Redemptorist financial officer, Father Ray McCarthy. Father, I said, would you like to sell your Handy Dan stock? They'd bought at a little over 9, and now it was at almost 15. They'd be making a cool $250,000 on the sale. So the priest says to me, Langone, is that an Italian name? Yes, Father, I was smiling to myself. This was feeling right. Are you Catholic? Yes, Father, I am. He said, well, under the pain of hell, tell me what I should do. Should I sell you the stock or should I keep it? I said, Father, I'm not messing with God. You keep your stock. And that's just what he did. Didn't regret it either. Chapter 6, Chicken Salad and Lemonade. You noticed, I originally named my little startup Invamed because I was so fascinated by the healthcare field, and now here I was in 1976, up to my ass in the home improvement business, and happy to be there. Contradictory, sure, Life is full of left turns, and I've taken quite a few of them, following my nose, which has very often pointed me in the right direction. The truth is I can't help myself. I'm a deal junkie. If the phone rings, I'm like the proverbial firehouse dog, off to the races. Who knows who might be calling? More often than not, it's someone who has a very interesting business proposition. Doesn't matter what kind of business it is. Handy Dan was an extremely interesting business proposition in 1976, and Bernie Marcus, I soon found out, was very much a kindred spirit. Oddly enough, he started his business career in the healthcare field as a Rutgers-trained pharmacist. This is how he came to Dalen in the first place. Then two friends of his, Amnon Barnes and Max Candiotti, knowing that Bernie understood merchandise and markups and service, asked him to go take over this little home improvement startup, which, as we've seen, Bernie turned into a big success despite the failures of the parent company. After I took my position in Handy Dan, Elaine and I became friends with Bernie and his wife, Billy. Every January, I used to rent a house in Palm Springs to play the Bob Hope golf tournament, and Bernie and I would golf there together. As we walked the course, we would inevitably talk shop, and Handy Dan continued to fascinate me. I began visiting the stores often in California and Arizona, where they were called Angels Do-It-Yourself Centers, in Denver and Kansas City and Houston. I used to love to go to the store openings. They always seemed so exciting and hopeful. One Thursday in the fall of 1976, grand openings typically happen on Thursday with lots of newspaper and TV ads and hoopla to get the momentum going for the weekend. I joined Bernie at the christening of a new Handy Dan in Houston, and Bernie and I were walking around the store when I saw something in the paint department that knocked my socks off. It was a big display depicting two cans of paint, one Handy Dan's house brand and the other a competitor, Sherwin-Williams or Glidden. The display showed the percentage of each can that was pigment and the percentage that was thinner. The more pigment, the better the quality. And here was graphic evidence that not only did the house brand have more pigment than the competition, but the prices were better. Oh boy, I thought that was wonderful. It was a big display, and the new store was a very big store, 35,000 square feet. Every place I went in it, I saw similar displays and signage, showing how this Handy Dan was going to educate and service the customer. Soon I was literally bouncing up and down. I thought this was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. Holy shit, I said to Bernie. If all the stores we open are like this, we're going to make a fortune. Just then Bernie grabs me by the arm. Don't get carried away, he says in a low voice. What do you mean, don't get carried away? He says, we're very vulnerable. To what? I can't tell you. What do you mean you can't tell me? I can't tell you, he says. We could be in trouble. Even though this store is great, even though all indications are that it's going to do very well, even though our business is doing very well in general, we could really be in serious trouble. What I didn't know at that moment was that Bernie had a friend in San Diego by the name of Saul Price. Saul Price had run a retail company called FedMart, whose market was military people. The concept was similar to a commissary on a military base. Service members and their families could buy everything from appliances and TVs to groceries at absurdly low prices. Saul had come up with this brilliant concept of buying in bulk and selling at very low profit margins in big, clearly organized stores. He then sold FedMart to a German company called Hugo Mann for a lot of money and started a new chain called Price Club, which was much like FedMart, only with a new idea, similar to what Costco does today, of charging membership fees to supplement his profit. One day in the mid-1970s, Price invited Bernie down to take a look at how Price Club operated. As they walked through the aisles, Saul said, "You see the store, Bernie? Someday somebody's going to do this in home improvement, and whoever does it is going to change the face of the industry dramatically. And if that somebody isn't you, you're going to be in trouble." Bernie never forgot that. It was hate at first sight with me and Sandy Sigler. Dalen's CEO and I met soon after I'd bought up all the Handy Dan stock I could. Sigaloff understandably wanted to know who was this guy he was suddenly in business with. So Bernie arranged a sit-down, and I flew out to the coast. Sigaloff was a brilliant man, a former nuclear physicist. He was urbane and articulate, slim and beautifully dressed. I would say he had the morals of a skunk, but that would be unfair to the skunk. He had a reputation for meanness. Bernie later told me that Sandy liked to call himself Ming the Merciless after the villain in the old Flash Gordon series. When Sigalor fired people, he didn't just let them go. He enjoyed hurting them, economically and emotionally, so they would think twice before ever turning on him. Bernie Marcus was still working for Sandy Sigalor, and not only that, but Bernie, together with his close friend and confidant, the CFO, Arthur Blank, was making a lot of money for Dalen, which was otherwise in very bad shape. In Sigalor's twisted view of the universe, Bernie's success made him, Sandy, look bad. So Sigalor made it his business to torment and push Bernie around at every opportunity. Once at a director's meeting, the two of them nearly got into a fistfight over how Handy Dan was being operated. When they went in another room to try and work it out, Sigalor's argument was that he was the boss and controlled Bernie's career, period. Then he demanded that Bernie repeat those exact words back to him. Bernie acknowledged that Sigalor was the boss, period. As for the rest, Bernie said, Sigalor could go fuck himself. Sigalor was a classic bully, but he wasn't my boss. I wondered if the day might come that he would try to bully me. That would be interesting, I thought. You'll remember how Dalen retained 81% of Handy Dan and put the other 19% in public hands, which became mostly my hands. I had 16%. This was a common corporate strategy among publicly traded companies in the 1970s. The belief was that the market would place a substantially higher value on a subsidiary if it was trading separately from the parent company, thereby lifting the value of the parent company's shares. Dalen executed that strategy with its subsidiary, Handy Dan. Tax law required the company to retain 80% or greater ownership to be able to consolidate the financial statements of the subsidiary with those of the parent. My intense buying of Handy Dan shares raised the price of the shares and in turn the public's estimation of the company. But who was to say that what had gone up wouldn't come down again? That's exactly what happened in three similar and very prominent cases. Right around the same time, Brunswick Corporation, which has sold 19% of Sherwood Medical to the public, suddenly bought all the shares back. TransUnion did the same with its water and sewage treatment subsidiary, Equidyne, and National Distillers and Chemical Corporation repurchased all its shares in Almaden Wines. In each case, the public issue had been underperforming. But that wasn't the whole story. A lawyer I knew named Fritz Brace, fellow board member of Sealy, represented all three of the companies that did these repurchases. And Fitz told me a fascinating thing. Underperformance wasn't the only thing that Brunswick, TransUnion, and National Distillers were worried about. What those big companies were also losing sleep over was their fiduciary responsibility to the minority stockholders. If the company made a move that the majority of the 19% didn't like, the stockholders might have a right to sue the company to change direction. In other words, the minority stockholders might really have the whip hand. It sounded backward, but it made perfect sense. A beautiful thought suddenly dawned on me. I phoned Sandy Sigalor and said, Sandy, I need to come see you. He didn't sound too eager to see me, but out to L.A. I flew. I strutted into Sigalor's office, just as arrogant and cocky as I could be, because I hated the son of a bitch. I sat down, looked in his eye, and said, Sandy, I think you and I need to have a talk about how we're going to run Handy Dan going forward. He looked shocked. What do you mean, we? He said. Look, Sandy, I said, I'm going to be reasonable, but I control a majority of the 19% of Handy Dan that's in public hands, and there is a very solid body of legal thought that says your fiduciary duty to me effectively gives me as much control over the company as you have. I gave him chapter and verse about Brunswick, TransUnion, and National Distillers. He looked like he was about to shit a brick, which, of course, made my day. I'm a minority shareholder, I said. But if you do something that hurts my interest, you've got a problem. If you want to make any kind of move that affects the company, the only way you can insulate yourself from big legal problems is to come to me beforehand and say, hey, I'd like to do this, and then to pledge you're going to vote your shares in direct proportion to the way the 19% votes. I can tell you this, Sandy, I said. I'm a very reasonable guy, and the likelihood of my saying no is going to be remote as long as you're doing the right thing. but I just think you and I ought to be in constant contact about our plans for the company. He was a petty tyrant, and all of this we and our stuff was making him crazier every minute. I've run into guys like this my whole career. They think they're the whole ball game, and they're always wrong. No one succeeds alone. Steve was practically coming out of Sigaloff's ears. This is the stupidest damn arrangement I've ever heard of, he yelled. I smiled sweetly. Okay, Sandy, I said. I just hope it doesn't get to the point where one day we have to test it. One day, about a month later, Sigaloff phoned me. One of his henchmen, a Dalen senior VP by the name of Jeff Channon, was going to be in New York. Sandy said Channon wanted to stop by and see me. It didn't sound like a friendly meet and greet to me. I phoned Joe Flom, the mergers and acquisition king at Skadden-Arps. He and his firm were known to be scrappy fighters and said, Joe, I don't know if I'm going to need a lawyer, but if I do, I want you to have the meanest, toughest SOB you've got standing by. I've got just the guy, Joe said, Bob Puri. On the appointed day, this Jeff Channon walks into my office, takes off his jacket, and immediately starts making threats. He's a lawyer, it turns out, and a thug. He tells me Sigaloff is taking Handy Dan private again, and my investor and I are going to have to sell out. No ifs, ends, or buts. And if we don't agree, Channon says he and Sigaloff are going to squeeze us out with something called a cram down, a legal way of forcing out minority shareholders. I knew exactly what a cram down was. If minority shareholders owned less than 10% of a company, the majority stockholder had the right to get an independent appraisal and force the minority owners to sell at that price. But a cram down required that the crammer control 90% or more of the stock in question. Sigaloff was bluffing. Jeff, cut the crap, I said. I control enough stock that you can't do any such thing. If you're here to threaten me, you've got the wrong guy. Excuse me. And I stepped out of my office and phoned Bob Puri. Puri came over in a few minutes. He was a story in himself, one of the smartest, most combative mergers and acquisitions lawyers ever to walk the earth. Talk about bringing a gun to a knife fight. Suddenly, Sigaloff's thug realizes he's in for it, but he gives it his best shot. At this point, Handy Dan was trading at about $8 a share. You can't sell your stock. You've got no liquidity, Channon tells me. All fake magnanimous. Meaning because between Dalen, the Redemptorist, and me, 100% of Handy Dan's stock was off the market. No one was promoting it or doing research on it. Therefore, there was no one to buy. You can't sell, Channon repeated, but we will pay you $10 a share. Make it 12 and you've got a deal, I tell him. Forget it, Channon says. I go to stretch my legs while Channon and Puri hash it out. When I come back to my office, Channon says, okay, I'll pay you $12 a share. Jeff, that offer's off the table, I tell him. I said, 12, you said no. What, he said, now I'm saying yes. Off the table, I said, I want 14 a share. Forget it, Channon says, I'm not paying $14 a share. Okay, I said, goodbye. I went to the bathroom, leaving my guy to rough up Sigaloff's guy a little more. Then after a couple of minutes, Channon comes into the men's room. All right, I'll pay you 14 bucks, he says. You don't get it, do you, Jeff, I said. I said 14, you said no, I want 17 a share. Well, a funny thing happens. There were two doors into the men's room, an outer door that opened in, and an inner door that opened the opposite way. And this thug lawyer, in his fury, tried to bang the inner door open, but it didn't go the way he thought it was going to go, and he smashed into it and got a bloody nose. Blood all over him. I'm thinking, this hassle's going to say I beat the shit out of him. Finally, he storms out and left the building. About a week later, Sigaloff calls. Let's not mess around, he said. We'll pay you 17 a share. Sandy, stop, I tell him. You had a chance and you blew it. I don't want to sell the stock. It's all over. You could have heard his phone slam down from 3,000 miles away. In the midst of all this drama, I was still calling on all my institutional clients, including Dr. Ellis at Pittsburgh National, who'd been so helpful when InfoEd was in trouble. Underneath his prickly shell, Doc was a generous guy, but that didn't make him one bit less arrogant or cantankerous. Beating up on brokers, including me, was still his blood sport, and he still had only one share in his office, his. Then one day in the spring of 1977, I walked in to find another chair next to Doc's, with someone sitting in it. The someone was a big, goofy-looking kid, maybe 23, 24 years old, with a huge mushroom of hair on top of his head. He looked like a wise ass to me, and a minute later I found out that's exactly what he was. I was only a few words into my pitch for General Motors, the stock I was pitching to Drellis that day, when Doc, in his usual fashion, started busting my chops about it. Why General Motors? Why not Ford? And then this kid who's working for him picks up the chorus, giving me the same kind of crap. What's wrong with Chrysler? It was like a tennis match. They had the rackets and I was the ball. The two of them were working me over, back and forth, and grinning while they were doing it. I took it for a few minutes, and then I said, Greek, I can take this for just a little while longer. Then I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to come around there and slap the shit out of you, and then I'm going to slap the shit out of this punk kid. Then I'm walking out of here. They started laughing, and that day was the beginning of my one-of-a-kind friendship with that punk kid with a mushroom haircut, who turned out to be a financial wizard named Stanley Druckenmiller. Steve Sato and his team had turned IVAC into a big success, but management, it became more and more apparent, wasn't Steve's strength. He had a lot of very talented people working under him, but for some reason he kept moving them aside. I soon came to feel that he had a deeply suspicious, almost paranoid streak. He felt his subordinates were out to undercut. This wasn't doing IVAC any good, and in 1976, I decided to turn another page and sell the company. Steve had been a good steward up to a point, but he wasn't the whole package, so we had to do something. Capitalism can be brutal that way. We ended up selling IVAC to Eli Lilly. Lilly did very well on the deal, and so did I. I was going from a highly speculative little company to a big company that paid dividends on its stock, and I wound up with a ton of Lilly stock with a value of the Lilly shares substantially greater than that of the IVAC shares. For the first time in my life, I was a millionaire, though I owned a lot of shares in all the deals I'd done at Pressbridge. Partners weren't allowed to sell without the consent of the other partners. My holdings were illiquid. Invimed, which had been struggling, was on firmer ground. The closing was November 30, 1977, in San Diego. Elaine was out there with me, and after the closing, we drove up to L.A. That night, Bernie Marcus invited us to have dinner with him and his wife, Billy, at their home in Encino. Billy made us a nice Chinese meal, and while Elaine and Billy were cleaning the kitchen up after dinner, Bernie said, "Come into the living room. I want to talk to you." We went into the living room. Bernie lowered his voice. "Do me a favor, will you?" he said. "Get Sigel off on my back. Sell him the stock." "Are you out of your damn mind?" I said, though I put it in slightly more picturesque terms. "What the hell do you mean?" I looked at Bernie for a moment. I could tell he was hurting. He was between a rock and a hard place, with that rat pressuring him on one side and me on the other, supporting him but hating Sigeloff with every fiber of my being. "You know what's going to happen once I'm out?" I asked my friend. "He's going to fire you. He hates you, Bernie. The only thing he's got of any value in that mess of a company is Handy Dan, and he can't take credit for it because you're there, and he ain't going to screw with you as long as I'm here." Bernie looked at me in the eye. "Please, Kenny," he said, "please, I can deal with the guy. Believe me, it's going to be better for me." "Listen, Bernie," I said, "it's no sweat off my back. I just sold the company. I've got a ton of Lilly stock. I'm in hog heaven. If you want me to sell, I'll sell. But personally, I think you're out of your fucking mind." Elaine and Billy were still in the kitchen talking, so Bernie and I went into his bedroom, and he called up Sigeloff's other lawyer, a guy by the name of Ed Kaufman, a partner at Irell & Manella, a big L.A. firm. I'm only hearing Bernie's side of the conversation. "I've got Langone here at my home, and I've got him persuaded to sell you the stock," Bernie says. He listens a moment. Then he cups his hand over the phone. "How much do you want?" he asks. "I'm going to make them an offer," I told him. "If they don't want it, that's the end of it, and let's drop it. If they want it, that's the price." "What's the price?" Bernie asked. "Bernie, I want $25.50 a share," I said. "Why the odd number?" "Because it has to look like we had some real hard bargaining here." Bernie told Kaufman the number. The lawyer said he'd call right back. The phone rang 5 minutes later. "Have that son of a bitch in my office at 10 tomorrow morning so we can get all the papers signed," Kaufman told Bernie. The next morning, Bernie picks me up at the Century Plaza Hotel, and we drive down Avenue of the Stars to Irell and Manella's offices. We park in the garage below the building. We get out of the car, and we're looking at each other over the car roof. "Bernie," I said, "I'm going up there, and I'm signing your damn death warrant. You understand that?" "You're wrong. They need me," Bernie said. They don't know the business. Trust me, Kenny, this is the best thing for me. Bernie, you don't own any stock. I know, but they're going to make it right. I shrugged. Okay. We went upstairs and I signed about 100 legal papers, making over all my handy Dan stock to Sandy Sigaloff at $25.50 a share. Not a bad return on investment from $3 a share. That was December 1, 1977. On Saturday, April 15, 1978, I got home from a business trip late in the afternoon, and my middle son, Bruce, he was 15 at the time, told me that a Mr. Marcus had been calling for me all day. I had two sound-alike Marcuses in my life, Bernie Marcus and Tom Marcus of EDS, the first guy Ross Perot had hired for his new company. Did he say where he's calling from? I asked Bruce. Yeah, California. I picked up the phone and called Bernie Marcus. Let me guess, you've been fired, I said. Is it in the papers? Is it in the papers? Bernie asked. No, I said. Then how'd you know? Bernie, you've been calling here all day. What else am I supposed to think? Understandably, Bernie was very upset. Not only had Sigaloff fired him, but he'd also shit-canned Arthur Blank and Ron Brill, Handy Dan's director of internal audit. A regular Friday night massacre. And he wants to put me in jail, Bernie said. What? What did you do? We had a labor law violation, Bernie said. He explained. San Jose was and still is a big union town, a very liberal city with a big General Motors assembly plant and heavy UAW representation, and there was an effort afoot to unionize the two San Jose Handy Dan stores. One of those stores was going to have a union representation election, and a group of employees went to Bernie and Arthur Blank and said they wanted to decertify out of the union, and Bernie and Arthur transferred to San Jose a number of employees from Phoenix who they knew would vote against the union. It was ballot box stuffing for sure. Unfair, maybe, but illegal. Sigaloff clearly thought he had a lever in his battle to seize total and final control of Handy Dan. You don't go to jail for that, I told Bernie. I hope so, but Sandy's pressing the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of California to bring charges against me. Ming the Merciless strikes again. How soon can you get to New York? I asked Bernie. I want to talk to you. Can you get here tonight? It was about 1 p.m. L.A. time. I said, I'll tell you what to do. I'll meet you in the Waldorf Astoria tomorrow morning at Peacock Alley for breakfast at 9:30. I've got to go to Mass out here, and then I'll drive in. Bernie said he would get on a plane. By the way, I said, do you know a good labor lawyer? I want to get to the bottom of this union mishigash. I've got a great labor lawyer. He lives in Jersey. We'll call him up and see if he can make it. We meet the next morning at the Waldorf. Bernie, his labor lawyer, Jerry Glassman is his name, and me. Bernie looks like shit. It's only been 48 hours since he was fired. Owned no stock, got no severance, no health care, nothing. And Ming the Merciless is telling him, I'm going to put you in jail. Okay, I've got a simple question, I say to Glassman. Is Bernie going to jail? No, of course not, Glassman says. This is a garden variety violation of NLRB rules. He's not going to jail, I say? He's not going to jail. At worst, the union is automatically certified as winner of the election, and all the employees become union members. Then, pal, I say to Bernie, I think you got hit in the ass with a golden horseshoe. What do you mean, Kenny? I'm out of work. I'm broke. Bernie, cool it. Cool it. We're going to start a company. Are you crazy, Bernie said. No, I said. Remember Houston? Remember what you told me? That there was something out there that if somebody did it, it's going to wipe out the industry? You were scared that if someone outside Handy Dan did it, you'd be sunk. Now you're the one outside Handy Dan. He looked at me, still miserable. Kenny, I have no money. Don't worry about it, I said. I'll come up with the money. For a brilliant nuclear physicist, Sandy Sigaloff was a pretty dumb guy. Because when it came to Handy Dan, his most valuable holding, Sigaloff just had no clue. Bernie Marcus knew, and I knew, that the home improvement chain Bernie had turned into a major success had huge vulnerabilities under the surface. There were just too many stores, too set in their old ways, to switch over to the Price Club model. Handy Dan's profit margins were okay, but they could have been better. The store service levels were generally subpar or non-existent, and the Handy Dan's product selections were minimal at best. Bernie and I knew that customers are much more likely to buy something if they feel they have choices. And meanwhile, believe it or not, Sigaloff had started to put himself into Handy Dan's advertising, strutting across TV screens and magazine ads like some second coming of Lee Iacocca or Frank Perdue. It was a total vanity exercise, though as we've seen, Sigaloff's vanity knew no bounds. He just assumed that thanks to his personal fabulousness, people would flock to his home improvement chain and Handy Dan would keep many money indefinitely, when in reality it was ripe for the plucking. I had a plan for Sandy Sigaloff. Was it personal? Sure it was. He had done dirt to my good friend and tried to squeeze me. Yes, I had come out of the business in fine fettle, but Bernie was still hurting badly. And Sigaloff's nonstop victory dance galled me, and not just because it was in bad taste. After he took back Handy Dan, I started buying up Dalen stock because I knew where the real value of the company was, and I had a pal of a friend in Peter Grace, the chairman of W.R. Grace & Company, which in the late 1970s and early 1980s was buying everything in sight. There was a famous story about Peter Grace. One late night in Southern California, he walks into a diner called Coco's Bakery. Total greasy spoon, but something about it appealed to him. Grace says to the waitress, "I want to see the owner." Some guy comes out with a sailor's cap on. Filthy apron. "I'm the owner," he says. "What do you want?" Peter goes, "I want to buy your restaurant." "It's not for sale." "It is for sale. I'm buying it." And he bought it and opened up a chain of Coco's that eventually included 145 locations. Made a good deal of money. I was at a Black Tie and Tails Knights of Malta dinner at the Waldorf Astoria in 1979, and I spotted Peter Grace. I went up to him and I said, "Mr. Grace, you ought to look at the Dalen Corporation. Dalen itself isn't worth doodly squat, but it's got Handy Dan, which is worth a lot." I eventually persuaded Peter Grace to do an unfriendly takeover of Dalen. In the meantime, I bought up a crapload of Dalen stock. Grace had a business development guy named Bill Riley, and in early 1980, Riley paid a call on Sandy Sigaloff. As Riley is walking into Sigaloff's office, Sigaloff's phone rings. Sigaloff picks it up. Riley's standing right there. The guy on the phone says to Sigaloff, "W.R. Grace just announced they're doing an unfriendly takeover of your company." Sigaloff puts his phone down and says, "I know why you're here. Somebody had jumped the gun." He says, "You're going to do an unfriendly deal on me." Riley says, "That's right." They negotiated the deal, and Sigaloff was gone. So I made money twice on that company. I said publicly a couple of times, "Every time I get near Sandy, I do nothing but make money. I hope he does something else where I can go after him." Bernie's revolutionary idea for a new chain of home improvement stores sounded great on paper. His vision was of enormous, high-ceilinged warehouse spaces, 55,000 to 75,000 square feet. By comparison, the biggest Handy Dan store was 35,000 square feet, featuring a broad spectrum of steeply discounted products. The discounts would be possible because Bernie and Arthur planned to buy directly from manufacturers, unlike Handy Dan, which purchased its limited selection of merchandise, the best sellers in every category, from middlemen and warehouses. In Bernie and Arthur's vision, new stores, huge size, wide inventory, and low prices would produce $7 to $9 million in annual sales per store. Handy Dan stores averaged $3 million in sales per annum. At gross profit margins of 29% to 31%, the industry standard was 42% to 47%. Sheer sales volume would compensate for the lower profit margins. And not just volume. The salespeople in the new stores wouldn't only be there to operate cash registers, they would be highly trained in home repair and home improvement, ready to answer all questions and guide customers through any project, small or large. It all sounded great on paper. I believed in it wholeheartedly. All Bernie and Arthur needed, I figured, was a year to study America and figure out where the first stores should be opened and how close to the ideal the stores could come. I calculated that the initial stage would take $2 million of venture capital to pay Bernie and Arthur salaries and fringe benefits and enable them to come up with a detailed business plan. The problem in May 1978 was that the business climate was lousy. Jimmy Carter was president and national confidence was sagging. Interest rates were climbing, energy prices and inflation were out of control. Not the best moment to drum up confidence in a daring new venture. I needed a contrarian with a couple of million dollars lying around. Who else but Ross Perot? I took Bernie down to EDS's Dallas headquarters to meet Ross, and the initial meeting went well. I set the table, telling the story of how Bernie had built Handy Dan into a great company, only to be kicked out to the curb by Sandy Sigaloff. Ross sat there behind his big desk all ears. Then it was Bernie's turn to talk, and to his credit, as impressed as he was by Ross Perot's success and commanding presence, and as much as he wanted Perot's help, he spoke straight from the shoulder. Ross, he said, I'm not interested in doing anything with you unless I know I'm going to deal directly with you. I don't want to deal through intermediaries, and I will not become part of your existing organization. If I have a problem, I will call you, and you and I will agree on how we proceed. I'm not going to be a captain or a lieutenant. I'm not interested in that nonsense. If we get caught up in corporate crap, I won't be part of it. But straight from the shoulder was right up Perot's alley. I like straightforward people, he said. No, I wouldn't put anybody between us. You have my word. Everything seemed to be moving along smoothly. We set a second meeting to explore the startup in greater depth and to introduce Arthur to Ross. A fourth guy also showed up at that next meeting, a retired CFO of Texas Instruments named Brian Smith, who was Perot's financial advisor. The second we all shook hands and sat down, Ross piped up, okay, what's the deal? What's the deal? I said, here's the deal. You're going to give us $2 million, and we're going to take the $2 million and use it to study America, to see where we can make our concept work. And if, for whatever reason, we can't bring it to fruition after a year, you get whatever's left of the $2 million, and these guys go out and find a job. That seemed okay with Ross. We laid out the basic ownership arrangement if the new company got up and running. The deal was going to be 70% for Perot, 25% for Bernie, Arthur, and their team, and 5% for Invermed. We agreed that until we went public, if Bernie and Arthur wanted to bring people into the work for the company, their stock would come out of Marcus and Blank's 25%. It was potentially, anyway, a very generous deal for Bernie and Arthur. In typical venture capital deals, the founders get just 10% of the company. So far, so good, except for Brian Smith, who, from the jump, was the skeptic in the room. He was a very nuts-and-bolts guy who simply didn't believe that no matter how great the new store's service and product selection and sales volume, Bernie and Arthur could make a go of it on 27.5% gross margin markup, when the industry standard was 44%. No matter how hard I insisted that service and selection and store size were certain to create big sales volumes, Brian Smith kept shaking his head. And there was another little detail. As proof of how parsimonious Bernie and Arthur were going to be with Ross's $2 million, I told Perot that instead of getting new company cars, Marcus and Blank would just move the car leases they'd had with Handy Dan over to the new company. Arthur, what kind of car do you have? Ross asked. I smiled. Now Perot would get to see what economical guys he was dealing with. Arthur said he had a 1972 Pontiac. Great. Bernie? Perot said. Bernie said he had a 1973 Cadillac, a five-year-old car with over 100,000 miles on it. But suddenly Perot's eyebrows shot up. Cadillac? Cadillac, he said. My guys drive Chevrolets. They don't drive Cadillacs. Bernie turned to me. Can we talk, he said. Sure, I said. Ross, can we use your conference room? Bernie and Arthur and I went into the conference room and closed the door. Bernie was whispering anyway. Kenny, he said, this guy's going to own 70% of our company, and he's busting my chops about an old Cadillac. What the hell else is he going to drive me nuts about? Let's get out of here. I looked at Bernie. Are you nuts? I said, this guy's about to give you $2 million. But he was dead serious. I don't think I want to have this guy as my controlling shareholder, Bernie said. In fact, I'd rather starve to death than have this guy as a partner. I took a deep breath. Back we went into Ross's office, where I tried to put the most positive spin possible on what just happened. Look, Ross, I said, we're all thinking about where we are. Brian's clearly got reservations about the deal. Why don't we all think this over for a couple of weeks and we'll get back and see where we are? Okay, Ross said, if you want to come back, come back. We knew we wouldn't be coming back. As we waited for the elevator outside Perot's office, Arthur was despondent. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? He said. We haven't got any money. Arthur, here's what we're going to do, I said. I'm going to go out and raise the $2 million. You guys are going to get 45% instead of 25. The investors are going to get 50, and I'll get 5. Arthur looked amazed. Hell, that's a much better deal than we would have had with Perot, he said. Yes, Arthur, I said. In the retail business, when you can't sell something, you guys mark it down. In my business, when you can't sell something, you mark it up. So I went back to New York and started raising the money. The first people I approached were the individuals who'd held a big block of Handy Dan stock that I sold back to Sandy Sigaloff at $25.50 a share. Those people had done very well indeed on their initial investment. I went to them and said, look, you had a good experience with Handy Dan. Now we're starting a company that's going to be much, much better. My initial plan was to sell 40 units at $50,000 apiece. Each unit would consist of preferred stock and warrants to buy common stock. I also approached my old friend Frank Borman. Frank was now an executive vice president and board member at Eastern Airlines. He would become CEO the following year. He had a decent salary, but no ownership at all. When I told him I wanted him to put $50,000 into my new startup, he told me he'd have to go borrow the money. I told him to beg, borrow, or steal it right away. That was how strongly I felt about this thing. Frank was on the board of Southeast Bank down in Miami, and when he went to them for a loan, the most they would part with was $25,000. I said, fine, Frank, I just split the units 2-for-1, and now you've got a $25,000 unit. That half unit, like the others I worked so hard to sell, eventually became worth many millions of dollars. Mitch Hart, too, was one of our first investors and would sit on our board from the beginning, and I put in $100,000 myself. I'd made a pretty good buck selling my own Handy Dan shares. I did the whole deal piecemeal like that, and it was ass-busting work. I particularly remember two guys I'd persuaded to put up $50,000 apiece, Artie Long and John Cornwell, who owned a New York proxy firm called D.F. King & Company. On the day we were going to close, they called me up separately and said they could only do 25 each. Oh, shit, I said to myself, because the whole deal was predicated on raising the full $2 million. So I called two other guys, the real estate developer Fred DeMattis and Tom Arcus of EDS. Both were already in for $50,000 apiece. Look, I said, do me a favor. Will you take another 25 each? They said yes, and I had my financing. One day that summer, Bernie called me from California and said, Kenny, you got to come out here. I've got somebody I want you to meet and something you have to see. Give me a hint, Bernie. I said, what is it and who is it? Somebody that's doing what we're trying to do, he said. I mean exactly what we're trying to do. I flew out. Bernie picked me up at LAX, and we drove down to Lakewood near the Long Beach Airport. The guy he wanted me to meet was named Pat Farah, he told me. And what he wanted me to see was Farah's tremendous 130,000-square-foot store, Homeco. There it was, shimmering in the sunlight, a huge warehouse at the end of a giant parking lot. We parked and went inside. The first thing I saw when we walked in was a mountain of cans of Coca-Cola, maybe 20 feet high. It was an amazing sight, but a puzzling one. I turned to Bernie and said, is this a home center or is he selling Coca-Cola? Bernie smiled. No, no, he said. He's selling brands. Well, that was pretty interesting. The first thing somebody sees when they walk into the store is this drop-dead display of one of the most popular brands in the world. It's welcoming, it's appetizing, and it's lifting the image of the store by association with a great brand. The inside of this gargantuan warehouse was home improvement heaven. Merchandise tacked to the ceiling, lumber sold right in the store, forklifts shuttling pallets of goods around. The sales associates wore tennis shoes, khaki shorts, and brown T-shirts with Homeco on the back and a silhouette of a house on the front. And they ran to greet each and every customer and ask what they were looking for. You could see by the smiles on the customers' faces that it was a sales strategy that was working like gangbusters. The store was also Farah's headquarters. Bernie and I went up to the mezzanine level and down a long hallway that led to the executive offices, lined up alongside the walkway were blue plastic milk boxes full of papers, into it which a young lady carrying a big stack of papers was depositing more papers, one by one, very rapidly. I was struck by how fast she was moving. She wasn't even looking at each piece of paper before she plopped it into this box or that. Excuse me, I said, I'm curious. Can you tell me what you're doing? Oh, these are the invoices from the vendors, she said. I'm filing them. How do you know where to put them, I asked. Oh, I just stick them wherever there's room, she told me. Oh, boy, this guy's in trouble, I said, Bernie. I know, he said. We walked into the offices, and there was Pat Farah, a force of nature, giving off so much energy that he was practically bouncing off the walls, a big, heavy Irishman with an Afro haircut, blue leisure suit, shirt unbuttoned down to the navel, and gold chains hanging all over his chest. He was captivating, he was exciting, he was crazy, bouncing up and down, bursting with ideas that bubbled out of his mouth in no particular order. As the store demonstrated, the guy was a retail genius. As his filing system demonstrated, he was no businessman. He didn't know a profit margin from a paint can. It turned out that Homeco was bringing in piles of cash, but it owed mountain to its vendors who rarely, if ever, got paid. Within 6 months, Pat filed for business and personal bankruptcy. And Bernie said to me, we've got to get this guy. We've got to. I agreed, I said. It clearly wasn't his financial acumen we wanted him for. It was his marketing and merchandising brilliance. So Bernie and I romanced Pat, and Pat agreed to come on board and bring his head full of ideas with him. We had a team. In June 1979, we had our first four stores ready to open, all in Atlanta, and we needed more money. Bernie had a buddy at Security Pacific Bank in L.A., the guy who had been the banker for Handy Dan. Rip Fleming was his name. Bernie went to see Rip, and Rip turned him down. But finally, after Bernie showed him a business plan on paper, Fleming said, I can get you a $3 million line, but I need collateral. Collateral? Collateral? One afternoon, Bernie and Arthur and I were sitting at the bar in the Century Plaza Hotel, and I was doodling on a cocktail napkin while they told me their troubles. Suddenly, I wrote down a couple of figures and said, here's what we're going to do. My idea was to return to the original investors once again and have them go to their respective banks and get letters of credit. If an investor had originally put up $50,000, for example, he would put up a letter of credit for that same amount, which would give him a warrant to buy $50,000 of stock in the company at a later time. If the loan went bad, the investor would have to pay Security Pacific $50,000. But the loan wouldn't go bad. I knew it. And my complete confidence in our startup was what convinced the investors to do it. Now all our startup needed was a name. The hunt didn't begin auspiciously. The first idea on the table was MB's Warehouse, which nobody liked. Then Bernie and Arthur hired a Toronto consultant to come up with a real doozy, Bad Bernie's Build-All. It wasn't just a name, it was a whole marketing concept. Ads for the stores would feature a cartoon Bernie behind bars in striped prison uniform saying, they've locked me up because I sold at such low prices. Rip Fleming, the banker, nixed that one, thank God. One night, Alan and I were having dinner in New York with our good friends and original investors, Marjorie and Walter Buckley, and I was complaining to them about the difficulty of coming up with a name for our newborn chain of home improvement stores. They listened and sympathized. I could tell that Marjorie, who's very gifted verbally and in many other ways, was thinking deeply about the question. The Buckleys lived in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and they drove back home that night. The next morning, Walter caught me up and said, we were driving back into Bethlehem, and we saw a restaurant built in an old train station. It was called the Main Street Depot. And Marjorie said to me, why don't they call the stores the Home Depot? How about that, Walter said. How about that indeed? The Home Depot didn't exactly get off to a flying start. At first, we had so little cash that we could only afford to open two of the four stores we'd planned to open, and we had nowhere near enough stock to fill those two stores. One of our suppliers, the faucet manufacturer Price Pfister, gave us an open line of credit, but the other vendors weren't so generous. Miles of empty shelves were not going to inspire customers' confidence. Then Pat Farah came up with a genius idea. He went to the vendors and asked them for boxes, just boxes, with a product label on the outside and nothing inside to fill our empty shelves. Customers would walk in and see what appeared to be prosperous stores packed with merchandise. And at first, Bernie was so worried about attracting customers that he used to shuttle back and forth between the two stores, standing outside the entrances and handing out dollar bills to anyone who'd go in. After those hiccups in the opening year, 1979, our two Atlanta stores started to do so well that we were able to open the other two locations, which also did very well. With four stores now running the block, we decided to go public in September 1981. It was time to expand beyond Georgia. We had our eye on Florida, and opening more stores meant that we needed more money. I went to the typical players, Drexel and Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns. Drexel turned me down out of hand. I had a relationship with Bear Stearns, but they were hesitant. They wouldn't get off a dime until I told them, it was pretty much true, that Merrill Lynch was interested. Merrill Lynch would eventually bail. I finally got Bear Stearns to agree to underwrite a $6 million equity offering. Half the money would redeem the original investor's preferred stock. The other half would go into Home Depot's business operations. But it was a dicey moment. The economy was in a recession. The market was in the crapper. Ronald Reagan had just become president, but Reaganomics hadn't yet worked its magic. Inflation was still through the roof. Paul Volcker and the Fed were pushing interest rates higher. And the week before the deal was set to get done, Bear Stearns told me it only had orders for $3 million of the $6 million. We simply couldn't raise enough money to redeem the preferred shares. I didn't have a cocktail napkin at this time, but I did have another idea. I went back to the original group one more time. Look, I said, we've got a simple decision here. If we don't get this underwriting done, we're not going to have the money we need going forward. So either we're going to have to put up more money or there isn't going to be any more Home Depot. Now, nobody wanted to put up any more cash. I'd expected that. My idea was to, in effect, create cash for the IPO by having the investors convert their preferred shares into common stock in the shares that were going public. Instead of taking cash for their preferred shares, they were putting it back into the company. I don't have to tell you, they never regretted that decision. And Bear Stearns was now able to sell the IPO for the complete $6 million. If there is anything I would take a bow for throughout this whole process, it would be this: never giving up and thinking creatively instead of just reactively when the chips were down. It's a style I recommend highly. You get to enjoy lemonade instead of the lemons God gives you, and chicken salad instead of the much less tasty alternative. Chapter 7. Guy walks into my office. By 1978, my good friend, an original Invamed investment banking client, Gary Erlbaum, had concluded that his Philadelphia area home improvement chain, Panorama, did not have a bright future. The economy stank at that time. It looked as if there was no way out. Gary, I told him, it's over. What we've got to do is get as much money as we can for your business and go look for something to invest in. Gary agreed. I helped him liquidate the company, and we ended up getting about $1.5 million for it. One day, not long after that, I got a call from my friend Joe DiMartino, who was one of the highest-ranking executives at the Dreyfus Corporation. A broker he knew at Shearson, then Shearson Hayden Stone, had sent him a client to ask about getting investors for an invention of his, Joe told me, and he didn't know what the hell the guy was talking about. Will you meet with him, he asked. Sure, I'll meet with him, Joe, I said. Send him up. The guy's name was Gordon Gould. Gould walks into my office, and I can't believe what I'm seeing. He looks like a mad scientist, wild hair, disheveled clothing, wires hanging out of his pockets, pocket protector with about 40 pencils in it. He's invented an important device, he tells me, and though the government had given him a patent on one part of the technology, he can't afford to fight in court for the rest. A guy named Eugene Lang, who started something called the I'd Have a Dream Foundation, has given him some money and promised to help him. Gould says, but Lang has done nothing for him. Meanwhile, dozens of companies are using Gould's ideas, ripping him off right and left. And what did you invent, I asked. I invented the laser, he said. No shit, I said. You've got the same problem I have. What are you talking about, he asked. Well, I invented the wheel, and they won't give me a patent either, I said. No, no, Gould said. There's a patent law firm in New Jersey that's done all the work. They'll tell you. It was so bizarre that I had to follow up on it. And the patent lawyers in Jersey told me that, indeed, this guy had invented the optically pumped gas discharge lasers, the former powered by light, the latter by an electric discharge in a gas medium. He'd first applied for the patents in the late 1950s, and he was lucky he didn't get them. There weren't any practical uses for lasers at that point, and the patents would have expired before Gould could have made any money on them. Talk about being ahead of the times. I made some more calls, and I said to myself, son of a bitch, you know what? There may be a business here if we can get the rest of those patents. I told Gary Erlbaum about it, and he was interested. So we took the proceeds from the Panorama liquidation and formed a holding company called Patlex. The name stood for patent litigation. The plan was to take the assets that were in the business to fund the exploitation of Gould's patents and the acquisition of additional patents. It was a real pie-in-the-sky scheme, but I thought it was just crazy enough to work. I couldn't do the deal myself because I owned too large a percentage of the company, and I knew no established investment bank would go for it. Instead, I found a fellow named J. Morton Davis, who ran a firm called D.H. Blair, which underwrote companies of a highly speculative nature. And Mort Davis went for it. He was excited about getting me, Ross Perot's banker, involved. Davis did a finance for us, but the way he sold his deal into the market was so bad that I had to go back in the next day and buy all the stock back for my clients. A few years passed while we litigate the patents. Now it's the mid-1980s. Then in 1986, we won two important court battles, and by the end of 1987, we held the patent rights on the vast majority of lasers manufactured in the United States. Soon we were signing license agreements with the likes of Kodak, Chrysler, Eveready, and Union Carbide. We had a two-pronged plan of attack. The first part was to get a very legitimate guy to be the public face of Patlex. Conveniently, right around this time, Frank Borman was retiring from Eastern Airlines. I went to him and said, "Frank, if you'll agree to take charge of this company, you can headquarter it anywhere you want in America." And Frank wanted to live in Las Cruces, New Mexico, so we gave him the company with the patents in it, and Patlex continued signing annual licensing deals right and left. The second part of the plan was to do these deals at very low prices, $50,000-$60,000 a pop per annum, because if you charge these big companies a lot, they might challenge the patents. They had deep pockets and legal resources. They might be able to get some court somewhere to say, "We don't give a shit what the patent office says, we're disallowing the patent." But that never happened because we were so very reasonable, and we went out and got between 200 and 300 licensees, bringing in a total of $10 or $11 million a year for Patlex. It was great cash flow. Gordon Gould had a piece, Gene Legg, who had done Squat, had a piece, Gary Erlbaum had a piece, and so did I. That wasn't the end of it. A couple of years later, I got a call from a guy who'd started an automobile finance company for subprime borrowers, people with bad credit. Was I interested in buying the company? I was interested. We bought the business, changed its name to Auto Finance Group, and folded Auto Finance Group into Patlex. We brought in a guy from Mercedes-Benz Credit, Al Steinhaus, to run Auto Finance, and he built it into a solid business. We were one of the first subprime finance companies, so we knew how to do it. We were very careful about vetting the borrowers and collecting payments. We took the loans to Wall Street, and Wall Street sold bonds against the loans, another income stream. It was a first-class operation, and we made a lot of money. Success attracts attention. In 1995, Bob Gillespie, president and CEO of Key Corp in Cleveland, got in touch with me and said he was interested in buying Auto Finance. Great. I told him what we wanted for the company, and Gillespie told me what he was offering. We were a buck and a half apart, and neither of us would budge. So I went to Cleveland to meet with Bob Gillespie. Over dinner, he told me that the banking laws wouldn't allow Key Corp to keep the patent laser business. "Wait a minute," I said. "I've got an idea. You keep the automobile subprime business, but you give us back the patents for the lasers, and I'll give each of our shareholders their proportionate share in it. We'll set up a new company, and we'll put the patents in," which is exactly what we did. We sold Auto Finance to Gillespie for $600 million. It was a stock deal. We got paid in Key Corp shares and held on to the patent laser business. Now we're right back where we started from before we went into the automobile finance business. So I'm going hunting for something to do with Patlex because I've got this cash flow from the licenses, but it's not going to last forever. The patents are going to expire in 2003. And suddenly applications for lasers are going through the roof. Every place you look, lasers are being used, laser pointers, CD and DVD players, surgery, industrial cutting, weapon systems. Remember I talked about left turns? Follow my nose. Bear with me now. You'll recall Jack Hite, the co-founder of EDS and the guy who introduced me to Ross Perot. Jack came to see me one day, said, "I've got a company in Florida called Database Technologies. They use clusters of PCs to mine motor vehicle registration, census data, arrest records, and more. A cop having this technology in his car, if he's chasing a guy who's speeding, can input the guy's license plate and find everything out about him